On this week's 51%, we hear from a pair of scientists working to address racism and decolonize certain practices of the scientific community.
Scientists are very attached to their systems, but these systems should not be so inflexible that they perpetuate injustice.
We also stopped by a community center in upstate New York that's using cooking to get kids excited about the STEAM fields. I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessie King. The murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in 2020 renewed widespread conversation in the U.S. about, well, a lot of things, from police brutality to institutional racism and the historic figures we choose to memorialize in our communities. Many a statue commemorating Confederate figures or people who owned slaves has drawn debate in the years since, some of them even coming down. We saw some buildings renamed and some organizations boost initiatives tied to diversity, equity, and inclusion. None of this is a new conversation. It was happening before George Floyd, too. And you may or may not be surprised to know that it's also been a long-standing conversation in the scientific community. Think about it. A lot of what we're taught about the world is done so through an Anglo and Western European lens, and that impacts the subjects we focus on, the technical names we use for different species, for which we often use Latin, and the scientists we even choose to listen to. Our main guests today specialize in botany and anthropology, and they argue these fields, as well as every scientific field, are embedded in colonialism. At a recent conference of the International Botanical Congress in Spain, they held a symposium arguing for how scientists can combat racist and colonial practices. Dr. Cynthia Sissy Fowler is an anthropologist, ethnobiologist, and chair of the Sociology and Anthropology Department at Wofford College in South Carolina. Dr. Ina Vandenbroek is an ethnobotanist and a senior lecturer and research fellow at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica. Ethnobotany, for those who don't know, is the study of how people in specific cultures use native plants and how those plants play a role in native cultures. Currently, Dr. Vandenbroek is leading a National Geographic study on the cultural heritage around certain Jamaican plants and conservation efforts. Speaking with our associate producer, Jody Cowan, Dr. Fowler and Dr. Vandenbroek say decolonizing botany and decolonizing science in general requires revisiting the names of scientific institutions and even species.
So we can look at things like the names of universities and colleges, and maybe just simply the names of buildings on university and college campuses. Let's say the U.S. South, to take, you know, where I'm located currently talking to you from as an example, you might find buildings that were constructed by people who owned slaves, and more specifically by the enslaved persons who were attached to those people. And the recognition of that labor may not have, you know, been made historically, but the decolonizing part is to start to make those recognitions and make memorials that recognize the labor that the wealth of the college and the success of its students and its faculty members and its administrators were built upon. And also some of the buildings, for example, are named after people who may be implicated in some very troubling, problematic instances of racism or misogyny. And so the decolonizing process that's happening and that's ongoing is to remove the names of people that are associated with processes that are related to colonialism, like oppression and white supremacy, erasure of indigenous knowledge, non-recognition of indigenous peoples and peoples of color, and with names of people who were successful scientists. You can see that everywhere from the U.S. South to the, you know, the Pacific, these kinds of explorations of colonial histories, and then attempts to kind of find some way to remedy the offenses that were caused by that.
Yeah, I'll add, like, continuing on the names, the plant names, and that's not only about the botanical names and the scientific names. And in the Nature article, they were speaking about a legume called Erythrina caffra. And the word is a derogatory term in South Africa. So there is logically that if a name is offensive, one should try not to be offensive in a more just and decolonial world. And so I do think when we're going back to the naming, the voting session at the conference, that International Botanical Conference in Madrid, where apparently it has been decided, and I've got this from Twitter. I wasn't there, and I'm not a taxonomist, so I'm not voting, but it was decided that only names that are being put forward are published after the 1st of January 2026 can be rejected as derogatory, and that those older names that are problematic can stay. And the taxonomists cite there that it would otherwise bring chaos in their universal naming system, in their universal system of nomenclature. But I do find that a missed opportunity in our objective to build a more fair, just, and inclusive science, where we're not going to perpetuate this insult of derogatory names. And what I'm also not understanding is that scientists are able to change the botanical name of a species after they do molecular genetic testing. So they have their molecular phylogenetic data, that is relational data. And based on that, they can say, well, no, this plant species more closely related to another group of plants. So let's change the botanical name. So that's perfectly valid. And a very, very well-known plant is rosemary, you know, rosemary, the nice smelling Mediterranean herb that was previously Rosmarinus officinalis and has now been changed to Salvia rosmarinus. So it's in a completely different genus based on this molecular data, this molecular study, and that's perfectly acceptable. So if that is perfectly acceptable, why is it not perfectly acceptable to really change names of plant species that might be very insulting to whole cultures? And it's not just the botanical names, it's also common names, right? You have a plant called dumcane. It's a species in the genus Diefenbachia. These are common house plants. Again, you know, dumcane was based on the fact that it's a toxic plant. So if you involuntarily ingest some of that juice of the plant, it makes you mute. You cannot speak. But it's also very insulting to people who are unable to speak. So why I don't see. I understand scientists are very attached to their systems that they built, but these systems should not be so inflexible that they perpetuate injustice.
Dr. Vanderbroek, you have in your presentation a breakdown of three different scales at which you're looking at decolonizing ethnobiology. Can you give me just a brief breakdown of those three scales?
Sure. So the scales are that we look at ourselves critically as researchers and ask ourselves the question, how can we be even unknowingly perpetuating injustice and not being inclusive? That's at the scale of the scholars, of ourselves. The next scale above that is looking at our projects and asking the questions, if we collaborate with other groups, being Global South scholars, majority world scholars here, not being part of, let's say, Europe, US, Canada, and so on. If we collaborate with these scholars, and if we collaborate with community members, members of indigenous groups, Afro-descendant groups, other local community members, are we inclusive enough? Are the outputs of our projects accessible to them? Are we writing about our projects in ways that everybody can understand it? Are we using jargon and only being able to talk among ourselves, and again, being exclusive? So that's at the level, and I can go on and talk a lot more about that, but that's at the level of our individual projects. So we have the scholars, ourselves, our projects, and then at the highest level, and that's maybe the most complicated level, because we're all embedded in institutions. We're part of universities, we're part of colleges, we're part of a publishing world. And are we sufficiently recognizing the leverage and the power they not only hold over us, but also over those who have been historically marginalized? So how are we being very careful not to perpetuate these injustices? And how are we good allies and activists for these causes? And that biggest, and in publishing, in scientific ethical publishing, that's maybe the biggest challenge. How do we challenge these oppressive systems?
Yeah, that model of three scales that Dr. Vandenbroucke provides is really a powerful way to help us figure out how to do the work. And as scientists, we are very invested in the methodologies and the techniques that we use to gather the information that we need upon which we can build our knowledge systems. A really important book in the history of this topic of decolonizing science is one called Decolonizing Methodologies, and the subtitle is Research in Indigenous Peoples, and it's by Linda Tuhiwai Smith. She published the first edition of this book in 1999, just to reference, you know, this is an ongoing process with a long history. Linda Tuhiwai Smith is a Maori woman, and she's the daughter of a Maori anthropologist. So the Maori are the indigenous people of New Zealand. And her father, who was the Maori anthropologist, was the founder of the first Maori studies department in New Zealand. I would just like to recommend this book, Decolonizing Methodologies, to everyone, including the members of the International Botanical Congress. And I wanted to comment on what Dr. Vandenbroucke was saying related to, you know, flexibility and how names can change. And one of the things that I see as very important with stability in terms of nomenclature in botany and in other sciences is, you know, having some kind of common language to speak among people from different language groups. And that standard language could continue to be the Latin binomial system, for example, that scientists studying biological organisms use. And it could be a pidgin or a Creole, like Gullah Geechee, which is a Creole language that's spoken in the South Carolina Sea Islands, Georgia Sea Islands, by Afro-descendant cultures. It could be like Tok Pisin, which is a Creole language spoken by people in Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu and other island groups in the region of Melanesia. It could be like Swahili, a trade language. We can also allow lots of different languages to be present in a larger nomenclature system. As anthropologists, we see that names contain a tremendous amount of meaning. And we find the loss of indigenous languages and the components of them, like the names for plants and animals, to be catastrophic in the same sense as the loss of biodiversity, as the loss of bird species, butterfly species, or bee species is. Languages contain meanings, contain knowledge, and names house histories and identities. There's no substitute For all of the meaning and all of the value that's incorporated within names. And I'll add one more thing here. As anthropologists, we hold up a concept called biocultural diversity. And that is that we recognize there's a tremendous amount of overlap between biological diversity and cultural diversity, and that the sustainability of one requires the maintenance and sustainability and celebration of the other. There's a lot more to say about cultural diversity and its value for capturing the richness of relationships between humans and biological organisms, and the importance for maintaining that those relationships. I'll end with that thought.
Growing up, on the bottom bookshelf of my grandmother's living room was the collected editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And thinking my whole childhood and largely into my adult life that, okay, here is the collected knowledge of the world in this volume of, you know, whatever, 1 through 13 in the index, whatever there. But then finding out, oh, there's the Africanus version. There's a whole other perspectives and volumes and kind of global reach and scale of information that is not presented in this Western perspective. And just being made aware that there's different perspectives, there's different people involved around the world in both the finding of the information, but chronicling it.
Exactly. Challenging that dominance of Western science and Western culture and looking only through that lens is what we're trying to get at, that plurality of voices, that meaningful biocultural diversity, that bringing together and celebrating not only plants and animals and nature overall, but inherently the cultural knowledge systems that are embedded in these natural systems. I think in the Global North, we have made such an effort to separate ourselves from nature. And there are so much wisdom and so many lessons to be learned from the cultures around us who have different teachings, who have different stories, who have different wisdoms, and kind of that we remain blind for as long as we look at science through a Western lens, through our own cultural knowledge lens. We're missing out on a lot. When Dr. Fowler was talking about the names and the wealth of information in names, I think sometimes it's for us, it might seem that this is so far removed from our lives. But even in our poetry and in our writings, you know, Shakespeare said, what's in a name that smells so good that they call it a rose? I mean, that impression of the senses and the actual identity of the species and the knowledge about it's all linked. And another final thought that I want to have is it takes a village of us coming together and really collectively, because of course, you know, within our fields, we can stand on our soapboxes all the time and preach to the choir, right? But I'm hoping by coming together as a larger collective and talking to journalists and going beyond our own disciplines, in my case, science, right? Bridging with anthropology, but also bridging with the traditional knowledge holders that I work with in the field, and then reaching out and gathering a larger collective. And just having these stories resonate, but at the same time, with the strong message to it that we shouldn't appropriate and that we shouldn't, you know, pick and choose what works for us while the traditional knowledge holders are still marginalized, right? That we can form this collective and do it in a just and inclusive way.
Yeah, revising nomenclature systems should take place in a community, a really broad, perhaps global community of people those who want to be a part of it.
Yeah. a phrase that I came across in your presentation, Dr. Vanderbroek, that I was really intrigued by was traditional knowledge holders. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So in the type of research that we do, ethnobotany and ethnobiology, but also the biological sciences more in general, let's think about plant sciences and taxonomists collecting plants in the tropics. These are places and regions where they go to collect plants to better understand plant diversity there that are not only very rich in plant diversity and in biodiversity overall, but that coincide, these areas coincide with the lands of traditional knowledge holders. This can be indigenous communities or other non-indigenous communities, but that still are very adhering to a traditional lifestyle where they have very close connections with nature. So in these area where scientists go collect plants, often part of their team are not only Global South scholars, but also members of these communities who very intimately know these environments and know where certain plants grow and what the multiple benefits of these plants and ecosystems are. Yet these traditional knowledge holders, and this goes back very long in history, they remain marginalized, they're invisible, their contributions are erased, are they not celebrated in any case. So this is something that needs to change. When we do our field work, they're our partners. They're my teachers. They know the environment much better than I can because that's where they grew up, right? I have one project in Jamaica, and that's about an endemic spice tree. So it's spice tree that's only growing there and nowhere else in the world. And it's a rare tree, and we don't really know or understand its conservation status. Now, local communities also know use that species. They intimately know it, therefore, and they know where that species grows. Since it's a rare tree, they know where to find it. So I heavily depend on them for even being able to carry out this field work. So they're my partners in research. I couldn't do what I do and be who I am as a scientist without my team members, and they deserve this full recognition. I mean, I always get a rash. It's very cringy when I see papers where scientists write that they discovered something that has to do with biodiversity research, because more often than not, it's not the scientists who discovered it. It's the people living there who really intimately know that environment. They have probably discovered it.
From where I sit here, upstate New York in North America, there seems to be a doing away with DEI initiatives, and a lot of these different safeguards in all different types of fields are being kind of removed as we get into different political theater things happening here. Does that affect the global science community in a similar way?
You know, yeah, that hits close to home, what you're talking about, the policies that are being passed by state legislatures in South Carolina, where my college is, in North Carolina, where my home is, are, you know, changing what can be done among administrators related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. For Dr. Vanderbroek and myself, our disciplines are kind of like the ocean, and the movement to do away with them are kind of like the waves. So the ocean's still going to be there. Our ocean within ethnobiology, ethnobotany, anthropology, and so forth. Anthropology is the science of diversity. If there is a science of human diversity, it is anthropology. So we're not going to stop. We aren't going to stop caring about diversity, and we aren't going to stop trying to understand it from not only kind of our science or our social science ways of thinking about things, but also, you know, in terms of ethics.
This is wonderful. I really appreciate the time of both of you, Dr. Fowler, Dr. Vanderbroek. I feel like this conversation could go on. I do want to just give you your days back. I know we've been talking for a while here, but I want to give you a moment to just leave a final thought with us if you can.
It's not a one-off. it's a continuous conversation, right? And listening to all these diverse perspectives, diverse ways of knowing that have been marginalized historically and into the present, and pushing back against that. And I just want to say, it takes a village, it takes community. We need to come together that to have that unity of open discussion. So I really also want to thank you so kindly with taking up this topic, giving us that opportunity to speak, and recognizing all those that came before us and those that are also working on this. It's tremendously important, I think, this whole concept. And I say this, I try to say biocultural diversity at least several times a week to bring out that topic, to stress that intimate relationship between nature and culture, and with community at the heart of it. Thank you so much.
That was Drs. Ina Vandenbroek and Cynthia Fowler speaking on decolonization efforts in the sciences with our associate producer, Jody Cowan. You can find links to more of their work at our website, wamcpodcasts.org. Before we go, a community center in Cohoes, New York, is teaching kids in the Capital Region about the arts and science through cooking. WAMC's Samantha Simmons brings us more.
In a Johnston Avenue basement on a hot and humid weekday afternoon, kids swirl around the kitchen, tying up their hair, washing their hands, and getting their recipe books ready as they prepare to make some sweet treats. The Connect Center for Youth is working to engage students in science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics in unconventional ways. During the camp's summer programming, Summer of STEAM, students spend the day doing activity-based learning exercises like baking.
Two and a half cups of all-purpose flour.
Renelle Turner of Nellie's Treats, a boutique bakery in Cohoes, is teaching a group of six how to make chocolate chip cookies from scratch.
We need to know how to bake. There's a lot of science involved with baking. There's reading, there's comprehension, skills that you have to work on. So I went ahead and figured, you know, it's something that I'd love to do with bake. Why not add those important components to the baking to make it fun for the children?
The self-taught baker was inspired while watching a baking show more than a dozen years ago. She says since opening her shop in 2021, she has been continually rewarded.
The smiles, the laughs, the, oh my goodness, I made this, I can't wait to take this home to my family, or, oh, I made this cookie and now I can bring it home to my brother, today's his birthday or whatever. So for me, that is the most rewarding part.
As the week of classes continues, Turner encourages the kids to be more self-reliant as they work their way through the kitchen.
Two tablespoons.
11-year-old Paige Hickok and 10-year-old Delilah Kors partnered up to become smart cookies. The girls write the recipe down in their notebooks as they add ingredients to the red mixing bowl. Both Hickok and Kors say being in the kitchen helps them learn everyday skills while rewarding them with a sweet treat.
It's much more interesting, and like you can go at your own pace, sort of. And I don't know, it's just better.
Yeah, it's just like it's more fun. Also, we don't just have to sit there and just like read something or do work.
Finished adding the ingredients, the girls use a hand mixer to combine them. Once they're thoroughly combined, the girls add the dough into a cupcake pan, making a pocket in the middle to add more treats. Chocolate bar bits and mini marshmallows give the cookie a gooey center. The trays are then whisked away and placed in the oven for 12 to 15 minutes. While they wait, Turner whips out the board game Perfection. The girls race to match the pieces to their corresponding holes on the board before time runs out and the pieces fly out. Turner compares this to the stressors of baking. Turner then takes the cookies out of the oven, warm, gooey, and sugary. Outside of the occasional kitchen workshop, Connect Center hosts after-school and summer programs to teach students about coding, audio engineering, acting, and drawing. All programs offered by the center are free and open to all students in grades 6 through 12 in the Capital Region. Samantha Simmons, WAMC News, Cohoes.
You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producers are Jody Cowan and Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my